Hello, and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast where Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts delve into the big issues in international affairs. My name is Lydia Khalil, and I'm a research fellow at the West Asia Program at the Lowy Institute. In May 2021, U.S. President Biden announced the complete unconditional withdrawal of U.S. military troops from Afghanistan by September that year. It marked the end of the U.S.-led coalition's military involvement in Afghanistan. This announcement had followed years of negotiations with the Taliban under former President Trump through the Doha peace talks. Its purpose was to facilitate U.S. troop withdrawal, end the Taliban insurgency, and set the conditions for the Taliban to enter into a power-sharing agreement with the current government. However, when the United States military withdrew in August, the Taliban, who already controlled substantial territory in Afghanistan, sped up their military offensive and swiftly took control of the country. Former President Ashraf Ghani fled the country as the Taliban closed in on Kabul, effectively ceding the country to the Taliban. With the Taliban now in control of Afghanistan, the country faces an uncertain future. Will the gains to civil society and women's participation evaporate under Taliban rule? How will the international community engage with the Taliban? To discuss current developments in Afghanistan, I'm speaking with Fawzia Koofi, a former member of the Afghan parliament and its first female deputy speaker, and a former member of the negotiating team involved in the Doha talks with the Taliban. Ms. Koofi, welcome, and thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Lydia, for having me. It's a pleasure.
So we had originally scheduled this interview many months back in August, but right when we were supposed to originally talk, the U.S. military withdrawal escalated, and then the Taliban had taken over much of the country and were essentially at the gates of Kabul. And all of a sudden, the situation was extremely fluid and volatile. The internationally recognized government in Afghanistan collapsed after the former president fled, and you yourself were forced to flee the country given concerns around your safety when the democratically elected government collapsed. Can you take us back to those days? Where were you when you heard the Taliban had taken control of Kabul? And what was your situation at the time? How did you make that difficult decision to leave Afghanistan?
That's right. We were supposed to have this conversation, I think, very few days, maybe 1 or 2 days before the unfortunate escalation of the situation in Afghanistan. Well, I was actually initially in Doha negotiating with Taliban in July, when my province, my own province, which I was the representative, most of it fell to the Taliban. And personally, I was offended because I had my family, I had my people who voted for me. And in that province, I mean, every inch of the land in that province witnessed my steps and something that I did for that people. So I was personally, you know, in a situation that I had to leave Doha to go to Kabul in order to mobilize more people and see how can we regain the territory. Because I knew that, you know, the military takeover is not going to be the same as a political settlement. And if Taliban take over through military means, they are going to do the same things because they feel absolute victorious. So I went to Kabul to see how we can mobilize leaders, political leaders, and more people in that province to regain or retake territories. Because this also happened in 2015 after the U.S. withdrawal. A lot of areas fall to the Taliban, but then we mobilized people. We supported our security forces, etc. We moralized them, and then they were okay. They functioned. But when I went to Kabul, I realized that, you know, already everything is starting falling apart. And there is a lot of fear, uncertainty, and people are talking about the Taliban advances. So, yeah, I couldn't go to my province because the airport was under Taliban eyes, basically control, very close to the airport were Taliban. So we couldn't land. And so I was in Kabul trying to mobilize when other places fall to the Taliban. Then we were supposed to go to Doha to negotiate a kind of final settlement on the basis of which power sharing was arranged and transfer of power to based on an agreement was also arranged in short time. Already you could sense, because I was in Kabul, the electricity was interrupted. Some days we didn't have electricity. A lot of nights Kabul was dark. And that those days reminded me of the civil war. I could get out of my home in the balcony and look at the city and the mountain, and everything was dark. And you could already sense that something bad is going to happen. But to happen that way, without any confrontation, and as a result of a former president fleeing the country, nobody actually expected that, because he was the one who always claimed that he is going to stay there at the last drop of his blood, and he's going to defend, etc., etc. He was making all those statements that try to give hope and morale, but he didn't mean it. And so On the 13th of August, the U.S. Embassy, which was very close to the palace, they moved to the airport to facilitate evacuation. And I think that was the reason when the president, the former president, who really did not have a lot of base and public support, then he, on the 14th of August, fled the country. And I remember that morning, everybody was basically out of their homes. You could just think that perhaps no one is in their homes, because people just wanted to escape. They didn't know where to go, but they wanted to escape that moment. And that was heartbreaking. It was terrifying to see Kabul was basically exploding from traffic. And at 4 p.m., then the Taliban entered. And I was in contact with their political office in Doha to avoid any, incidents or attacks or, killing and violence. At some stage, their political office was also not aware that the Taliban militants will enter. Entered, and at 8 o'clock, I think, 8 p.m., the three-color flag of the palace replaced with white and black color of Taliban. Yeah, which was heartbreaking, because nobody actually foreseen that things could rapidly escalate in that situation. But I think it was because of the president's fleeing the country irresponsibly that resulted that chaos.
Yes, it certainly seems that the president's decision to flee the country escalated all of these things and didn't leave time for any further negotiation, and certainly led to a lot of uncertainty. The world also saw all of the footage around people trying to leave Kabul around the airport, all of the issues around the evacuation flights happening at the time. How did you leave? How was it for you departing Afghanistan?
Well, when the president fled that way, of course, as leaders, we set examples. We are role models on what we do. When the president and his close inner circles flee the country, that already the city was in a mode that everybody was out of their homes to escape, but they didn't know how to and where. So when the president fled, I think that motivated a lot of people to go to the airport without knowing what will happen. And that's why you saw thousands of people, even before the evacuation start, they were waiting for any flight to take them out of Kabul. But they were afraid. They were afraid of uncertainty. They were afraid of violence. I think a lot of them were fed up with all these changes, military changes that they have seen in their lifetime in Afghanistan. One regime fall to the other one through a military, overtaking. I was also in Kabul, and my intention was not to leave. And I actually, on the same date, on the 15th of August, I sent a video message to the people that they need to be calm and just try to motivate them. But when Taliban took over the next day, they actually start searching houses, arrested some people, put some people in house arrest, including myself. The city was again empty. When I woke up in the next day, it actually reminded me of the time that the Taliban took over. Everything looked the same, except the buildings, except the development that happened in the city in the past 20 years. and the social media that was active, everything was as 20 years reversed as 20 years back. I decided to stay in Afghanistan. So although there was evacuation, it was my personal decisions, but at some point I felt that I'm not efficient anymore. When I wanted to leave, the Taliban did not let me go. They put me basically under house arrest. And so, but I had, with Taliban's kind of security escorting me, I had some meeting with some of the leaders from, you know, the previous leaders that were in Kabul to see if there is still a way we could negotiate, because we were supposed to leave to Doha on the 16th of August for a final kind of agreement. So I had a meeting with some of those leaders, and we realized that there is no hope for a political settlement, because the Taliban basically thought that they have won militarily, and they don't see the need for a permanent inclusive settlement. Then I realized that it's getting even difficult for me to function. I was basically another housewife out of 17 million women in Afghanistan. I was one of them, not being able to function, not being able to do and be efficient, deliver. Then I decided to leave. And of course, there was a long process of negotiation with Taliban from some of, from Qatar. And then I left with Qatar Airways to Doha. But I left my heart and my soul in Afghanistan. Those were, and until now, very, very emotional moments. I know I will go back. And there are times that I have been out of Afghanistan for a month or so, especially during negotiation. But to see that your country in that situation, especially when I went, when I came to the airport and I saw that everything was destroyed. It was a functional, normal airport. But everything was destroyed, including the screens, the chairs, the airport. Like, it was, for me, it was beyond the humanitarian cause. It was my country. It was just not any, for many people around the world, perhaps they, when they see those footages, it's a humanitarian cause that breaks their heart. But for me, it was beyond that. It was a country that I contributed to every step of the progress. I was part of all of that. To see that in that situation, it was very emotional. I couldn't stop my emotions, at least for 3 days after that. And until now, we get very emotional quickly. I think we are all traumatized for what happened to our country.
It must have been an incredibly difficult and, as you said, traumatic decision to leave your country and to do what you needed to do. There was, though, I note in the beginning when the Taliban first took over, there was talk and wishful thinking of a Taliban 2.0. A Taliban perhaps that was more reasonable, one that wouldn't revert back to the draconian rules of the 1990s. You were involved in previous negotiations with the Taliban, as you've said. And from your experience in talks and negotiations with the Taliban, have they changed? Can they be influenced? Are they open to international community pressure? Is this thinking of a Taliban 2.0 or a next generation Taliban just wishful thinking, or is it a possibility?
My hope was that through negotiation, we will be able to do two things. First of all, by including women and religious minorities in the negotiation, we could make it a norm for Taliban to accept the fact that Afghanistan is a diverse country and all the social political segments of society should live in peace and harmony with each other. And the second was that to tell them that the country is not the country that they took over in 1996. In 1996, there was already a civil war, and Taliban actually took over with the promises of peace and stability. And people initially welcomed them without knowing their actual politics. And we remember that when they took over initially, that's why they quickly took over. But when they took over Kabul and everything turned around, people then became against them. But now Taliban did not take over from a civil kind of war, a collapsed system. There was a system, there was a government, three pillars of government were functioning. Yes, the president and his team were not delivering, people were not happy with them, there was corruption, but I mean, there was a system, free media, a judiciary, parliament, executive branch, some level of presence of government was visible. So the Taliban really needed to respect that transformation. And that was the message I wanted to give, or we wanted to give to them. Palestinian. But I think when the Taliban hardliners took Kabul, they feel less need for being tolerance and open and acceptance. Those that were in Doha, some of them, you know, were not part of that military takeover, and they are highly fragmented now. The hope to influence, we need to continue to keep that line of communication, because you know, what they do is basically in contradiction to what happens in the rest of Muslim world when it comes to women's education, women's work, you know, respecting the religious minority, inclusion of Afghanistan's different diverse group in the political structure, etc. They are in, until now, they try to be the same people that they were in 1996, while the country has transformed. So it's for them to adopt. And I think that line of communication and pressure by international community will make a difference. But the concern I have right now is the geopolitics engagement and Afghanistan once again becoming a, you know, battlefield for all these superpowers. Although there is a vacuum of those countries who strongly stood for human rights and women rights, we know that more, the region is now influencing the politics. So with all of that, I think Taliban have a chance of leverage, play with a neighboring and regional country. Countries involved. So less hope, but still we need to keep that line of communication, because they need to know that they can only live with peace and harmony with the rest of the world.
Well, I want to ask you about the regional and the geopolitical situation, but before I do, I want to ask you again about internally in Afghanistan. You know, you mentioned that the Afghanistan now is not the one that the Taliban first governed. And there's a young generation in Afghanistan now that never knew life under Taliban rule. Do you think that the Taliban can ever be legitimate in their eyes? What is this younger generation's response to the Taliban?
The younger generation response to the Taliban was very clear. When they took to the streets of Afghanistan, taking enormous risk, protesting, and they continue to do so either through media, social media, or actual civil disobedience, is an example of the fact that Taliban, with their deeds and their oppressive measures, are not legitimate in their minds and in their eyes. Because we know that after Taliban took over, especially women, they never actually kept silent. Yes, it's not a big protest, because it's very, very difficult. It's extremely difficult to face that group. Very risky, actually. But still, you see that. So I don't think, actually, the Taliban will have that legitimacy until, unless they, you know, listen to the people, they form an inclusive government, they let women of Afghanistan to participate in politics, social, economical, and education life. They need to use the example of the rest of Muslim world. They cannot be in segregation with the rest of Muslim world. So no, I was talking to a group of young students, grade 12, yesterday. This is like their last year. They should graduate in 2 weeks from high school to enter university. Now, by Taliban banning them from school, actually, they have taken 1 year of education from them. This is heartbreaking. They were telling me that we will continue to protest. We will continue to raise our voice. They were asking me to continue to do that on their behalf in the international sphere. And they were telling me that our slogan is our rights should not become our wish, which is important. It's their basic rights to go to school. And I don't think that until that responsive and accountable government is formed, any other power, de facto power, will be legitimate in the minds and hearts and eyes of people in Afghanistan.
And in addition to that, Afghanistan is facing a number of challenges. There's cash shortages and food shortages. There's security threats from the likes of the Islamic State, the withdrawal of international aid. We know that the Taliban is a formidable insurgent and military force, but can they deliver as a government? Can they actually govern? And do you think that they can stay in power?
If they continue to practice and to do what they do now, oppressive exclusionary politics. I don't think that they can sustain their power for long. And that sustainability comes through, you know, being accountable to the people and trying to bring constitutional order. The threat is not really another military extremist. Yes, the threat from ISIS is on people. People pay the highest. And we know that in the last couple of weeks, for instance, the civilian places, including the mosques, were the target, so not the Taliban. So I don't think the response to weaken Taliban would be Daesh only, but I think the response will be the people's, this, you know, unhappiness, which is increasing because the Taliban that I negotiated, they are good in fighting, but they are not good in governing. They are actually, most of them are outdated, and that's why the only thing they do in the past 2 months is basically, you know, issue back-to-back decrees on how to ban women from school or education or work, and nothing specific and concrete on governance. So yes, I think if they do not really listen to the people in forming an inclusive government where all ethnic groups are part of it, women, meaningful representation, constitutional order is, you know, restored, and then strong institutions are established that will prevent the growth of Daesh. I think they are not going to win at this stage. I see it very difficult for them to be able to sustain.
I'd like to take it back to your personal experience. You've negotiated with the Taliban, but you've also been the subject of an assassination attempt by them. In fact, multiple assassination attempts. What was it like to sit down with representatives of an organization that tried to kill you? How did you deal with that as you were sitting across the table, and how did they respond to you?
Sometimes it was emotionally hard to process everything that I was going through in the negotiation. Not only because they targeted me. And last year in August, for instance, my hand was injured. And until now, it is not properly functioning because there was a three bone fracture. Sometimes when the weather gets cold, it hurts more. Not because of that, but because of everything that happened in Afghanistan. I was living all my life in Afghanistan, including the time the Taliban were first in power. And I could see how they were actually treating women, including, I mean, everyone, like the way they whip women, the way there was public execution. And we still remember those footages. Perhaps the world has remembered the footages, but I have seen it firsthand. So it was very difficult to process that. But we were, you know, I was doing it, and we tried to lobby for more women participation in this process, because I think this peace process in Afghanistan was about women's rights, and everything in Afghanistan now is about women's rights. That's what the Taliban main focus is. Instead of delivering to the people, addressing their poverty need, the rule of law, you know, governing, they actually focus only on women's rights. And they think only if women use their fundamental Islamic and human rights, Islam will be at risk, which I don't understand this logic. But I did it. We did it. This was a very, very difficult, you know, few years, 2-3 years. It was another level of women rights, Lydia, because it was, we were in a process which was extremely sensitive. We already had internal battle with our own colleagues, because women rights in Afghanistan has always been a traditional, there has always been a traditional attitudes toward that. So even our own colleagues, sometimes we had to struggle to make ourselves visible. Mm-hmm. But then in the negotiation was another level. So yeah, it was hard, but we were continuing our battle, and we tried to really be our best self in order to demonstrate a good representation of women of Afghanistan.
Now, you alluded to the regional situation with the U.S. military now withdrawn from Afghanistan. What country now do you think will have the most influence? Is it a country in the regional area like Pakistan or China, which the Taliban have tried to increase their engagement with? What do you see as the regional and the geopolitical situation now with the U.S. military essentially ceding that ground?
Well, we know that China and Pakistan are partners on many foreign policy. They have close economic ties. And we know that Pakistan tried to strengthen their relationship with China to the extent that their partnership will substitute the Pakistan partnership with the United States, especially after the U.S. pressure on Pakistan about their counterterrorism policy. So Pakistan already have something which is not happy, and therefore I think their close relationship with the Taliban in the past and now is shaping a new area of collaboration or influence between Pakistan, Taliban, China, and foreign region. We know that Qatar, for instance, is a new interlocutor. All of these developments, Russia still have their embassy in Afghanistan, Iran the same. So we know that the politics in the region is basically shaped based on the US, China, and Russia relationship, not based on the interest of the people in Afghanistan. And that is the sad part of it. We know that the human records of these countries are not the same as, these countries have their own human rights issues. So in the absence of human rights monitoring mechanisms in Afghanistan and strong institutions, it's actually the people of Afghanistan that will be once again in the forefront of paying the highest price in this emerging geopolitics. And that's why I think, the UN, EU, and the world must really empower the people of Afghanistan to the nation to be able to stand for their rights.
That leads me to ask you if you think there is still a way forward, given the changing geopolitical situation, to continue to advocate for women's rights and human rights and democracy in the way that you have, absent the United States' involvement, which has been, during the time of its involvement in Afghanistan, the biggest proponent of women's rights and human rights. Given the new regional situation, is there room for you to continue, and others like you in Afghanistan, to continue to advocate in this new geopolitical and regional situation?
Well, Lydia, for me, the matter of fundamental rights of people of Afghanistan, and especially the woman, is not just a matter of social, political, a discussion, but it's beyond. It's actually directly linked to the regional security and in a wider definition to the world security. Because remember, in 1996 up to 2001, we were claiming that Afghanistan is a victim of military extremists and people are a victim, but the whole world was silent. And our claim was that that if Afghanistan is led by a power that does not recognize 55% of its population, then of course it's not a reliable partner to the world as well. But then the world was silent, and few countries also recognized Taliban in the region. And the world always regarded the situation as a civil war, which was not. In the absence of strong government, we know that there was an opportunity for growth of other military extremist groups, including Al-Qaeda. So again, after 20 years, we are seeing the same situation, experiencing the same situation. And once again, for me, if there is a government de facto power in Kabul that is not respecting the diversity of Afghanistan, does not is not accountable for what's happening in the country, means that that government or that de facto power is not a reliable partner for the world, and means once again it paves the way for the growth of other military extremist groups to use Afghanistan as safe haven. So therefore, I think it's for the world and for all of us to ensure that one of the strong benchmarks for Afghanistan not being used by military extremist groups to threaten our people, but also threaten the world security, is how the de facto power behave with ethnic inclusion, with woman inclusion, with religious minority, how they govern, how they function. And therefore, we will continue to pressurize. We will continue to support those women protesting. We will continue to support education activists. We will continue to support women civil society activists in Afghanistan or outside Afghanistan. Taliban took over militarily, but they lost a generation of extremely accomplished people in Afghanistan. They are in exile, most of them. We try to create different networks to connect them so that they use their, you know, knowledge, their talent in advocating for the people of Afghanistan. I think the world should stand in solidarity with us for their own security.
Well, my final question is, we've heard from a lot of people around the world, certainly here in Australia, who feel for what's happening in Afghanistan, who are concerned about what's happening, are mourning the loss of some of the rights and freedoms that have been enjoyed, and are particularly concerned and are wondering what they can do, what can they advocate for? And you're someone who's accomplished a lot personally and professionally during your time in advocacy and politics in Afghanistan. You were the first woman in your family to go to school. You've been a women's rights advocate for decades. You rose up in Afghan politics. And you did this all at great personal risk. So you've clearly committed everything to this cause, and you clearly are not going to abandon it. So what would your message be to people who are interested in bringing attention to this? And what would your message be to governments in the international system? If you had to say, you know, two or three things that you would have asked of the international community going forward, what would they be?
Right, Lydia. I mean, Afghanistan is my passion, and changing the life of my people has always been main part of my life. Even being in a hotel room outside Afghanistan, waiting for the situation to clear for me to be able to go back, still 80% of my time is dedicated for Afghanistan. And it's heartbreaking and emotional to see that, yeah, to see the country that I have dreamed otherwise is in that situation. Once again, my message to the world leaders would be that if Afghanistan has become once again a safe haven for military extremists, your own security will not be guaranteed. In order to avoid that, I think they need to continue to pressurize Taliban to listen, to form an inclusive government where everybody see themselves in a power structure. We already know that in some provinces, local Taliban, for instance, kept schools open for girls. That already is a sign, an indication of maybe it's time for Afghanistan to start decentralizing the political structure where every ethnic group and political and social segment of society see themselves. So for the world to work with people of Afghanistan to form an inclusive government where women and men are part of it, and eventually be a reliable partner for them. If there is no government that is accountable, that is not inclusive, that women are not there, that ethnic groups are not there, that religious minorities are not there, we will expect another 9/11.
Well, Ms. Fawzia Koofi, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, to offer your analysis and your thoughts. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute, hosted by Institute experts, with production assistance from Josh Gooding. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode of Lowy Institute Conversations.